Thanks, Jason, for reading, and hello. Let me add my welcome to Samuel's. My name's Andrew, if we haven't met. I'm one of the pastors here, and it's good to see lots of people, but also quite a lot of new people. So I've actually not been here the last 2 weeks because we have two morning services, one in Canada Library, one here. And so if you arrived in the last 2 weeks, I won't have met you, and if you're here for the first time today, I haven't met you. So a special welcome to you. I'd love to chat to you at the end if you can stay around for tea and coffee and refreshments at the end. So, wow, this is quite a passage, isn't it? Luke chapter 11, Jesus saying to the Pharisees, woe to you, woe to you. I think this ought to be kind of popular. If it was turned into YouTube, it would be popular particularly among young men. I see there's some young men out here today. You know the kind of headline of the clip that says, watch Jordan Peterson roast Kathy Newman, and then, you know, it's got a million hits or 10 million hits or something, or watch Kamala destroy Donald Trump. And it always has this sort of very, well, this is watch Jesus roast, watch Jesus destroy the Pharisees. And he doesn't hold back, and he really lets them have it. He lets rip. Woe to you. Six times, woe to you. In fact, in Matthew's gospel, it's even worse. There's eight of them, woe to you. It's not a word that we use much in everyday language, is it? Woe. It's actually a Greek word that's sort of like saying woe backwards, so away, or like if you imagine the sound of whoa, it is the word that sounds like what it means. It's like, oh dear, it's the kind of sound you might make at a funeral as you're lamenting for somebody. Oh dear. Oh dear isn't quite, that's a very polite English word saying it, isn't it? But that's what it means to you. Jesus isn't always this rude. Worth saying, but sometimes he really lets them have it. There's a backstory to this encounter which puts it in context. So if you invite Jesus to dinner, he's not always going to be this rude to you, but there's a backstory to these people. In fact, this is the third dinner party the second of three dinner parties in Luke's gospel where Jesus meets the Pharisees for dinner, but they're not friendly to him, and here they're not friendly, but there's a backstory. Jesus already predicted that he's going to be handed over by the chief priests, by the teachers, by the scribes. These are going to be the people who are going to kill him. He's already said that in chapter 9. And you already get a hint of that, because every time we meet them, they're tutting. Tut, tut, tusk, tusk. You know, what does he think he's doing? Jesus eating with tax collectors and sinners. What? And they shake their head in disapproval at Jesus. Every time we've met them, actually, since chapter 5, and then again chapter 7, and then again here, they're opposing Jesus. And the opposition's actually got pretty extreme in the previous passage. And again, it really helps put it in context. They've just said to Jesus, you're doing your miracles by the power of the devil. So don't think sort of friendly dinner party and then Jesus very rude. Think this is a group of people who's decided that Jesus is satanic, and this is what he has to say back to them. He goes on the front foot, woe to you. And I think one of the reasons he does it is not because he's particularly expecting Pharisees to be reading this gospel. I mean, Luke is writing for a guy called Theophilus. He's a Christian, and Jesus isn't saying woe to him. He's not particularly saying woe to you. He's saying woe to religious people who reject Jesus in a religious way. And we've got to get that sort of context in our head. But the thing is, religious people, not only do they oppose Jesus, but as we're going to see as we look at these verses, they can be a real hindrance to other people coming to know Jesus. Religious people can be one of the biggest barriers people wanting to know Jesus. And that's quite a shocking thing, and Jesus is going to expose that in these verses. When I was in the sixth form at school, so when I was, 16, 17, there's all sort of extracurricular activities you could do, and I chose to learn how to type. And at the time I was mocked for it, because it wasn't the cool thing for a 16-year-old boy to do. I went to this typing class, and it's probably the most, I mean, a bit harsh, but one of the most useful things that I learned at school was how to touch type. It certainly saved me time in essay crisis, you know, since then. And I can rattle it out pretty quickly. But The thing about touch typing is if you've learnt to type wrong first, it makes it way harder. Niamh's nodding, you've tried as well. If you learn to type the wrong way, so if you got, you know, you got quite quick on two fingers, it's really, really hard to learn to touch type, because when you first learn to touch type, it's really slow, and you've got all these bad habits that you have to unlearn. So arguably, a little bit of bad typing sets you a long way back. And I had to spend weeks with a tea towel over my hand so I couldn't look at them, because I wanted to see where that letter was, and I had to cup them so I can remember, oh, where's that Q? Oh, it's somewhere over there. And I meant to do it with this finger, and that kind of thing. Unlearning bad habits, and I think probably the same is true of golf, and there's all sorts of things. If you learn it wrong the first time round, and maybe it's true of musical instruments, Trinity Lab, people can tell us, is it, if you learn to play the violin in the wrong way, it makes it worse. Anyway, the same thing's true about religion, actually. If you learn the religion the wrong way, or if you have a bad experience of church from rogue, fake teachers, it can really set you back. So I sort of think, well, surely the atheist would be the hardest nut to crack. And then the person who's grown up in church, that'd be easier. No, not necessarily. And it might be that you're here today. I don't know some of you are. It might be you're here today, or you're here on the live stream, and you've had a really bad experience of church. In which case, it's a bit of a miracle that you've given us another chance. So thank you. Because Jesus knows that a bad experience of religion, it can hinder people. Well, let's have a look. And it starts off, Jesus is speaking. He's had this conversation about, I'm not from the devil. I'm actually from God. And then a Pharisee asks him for dinner. And I say, it's not necessarily a warm invitation. It's kind of an invitation from someone hostile to take it a bit further, to have this debate with Jesus. And straight away he's offended. The Pharisee was astonished to see that Jesus didn't first wash before dinner. Now, I don't know whether you'd have been similarly astonished. I don't know what the standards of hygiene and etiquette are in your house, or if someone does the wrong thing. In fact, I had a major breach of etiquette early this morning. I'll tell you about it later, but I made a bit of a faux pas. And whether you're like that, oh, I can't believe he did that. I don't think it's not necessarily means that Jesus is unhygienic. It's just Jesus hasn't gone through the extensive religious ritual of washing that the Pharisees were into. The Pharisees are astonished. What? And it links with this whole theme of their astonishment at Jesus. Why does he eat with people like that? Why are his moral standards so low? Why does he do things like that on a Sabbath, which is meant to be the holy? And this whole history. And this is the latest in this whole series of things. How come he doesn't wash? And immediately Jesus goes on the offensive, verse 39. Just look down. It'll be helpful if we look at the verses. We can look quite closely at each verse today. Verse 39. The Lord, Jesus, said to him, now you Pharisees cleanse the outside of the cup and of the dish, but inside you're full of greed and wickedness. Fools. Didn't he who made the outside make the inside also? Give his alms those things that are within, and behold, everything is clean for you. Jesus introduces the central problem with this fake religion, that it looks good only on the outside. It's preoccupied with what's on the outside. So in Matthew's Gospel, Jesus calls them hypocrites. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. And that word really sums it up, even though the word's not used here. It's the same idea. Hypocrite is to be someone who shows one kind of face, but there's a different kind of reality. You know that. We race the politicians, don't we? Because they have one kind of face, like you must socially distance and you're only allowed six people in the house, whatever. And then meanwhile, it turns out they're all having big parties in the cabinet office. And people are scandalized by that. The difference between the public outside and the reality. Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, he resigned a couple of weeks ago. One of the things that made him so unpopular was that he was quite unforgiving and brutal when people made small safeguarding errors. And then it looks like he made even bigger safeguarding errors. Then the day after he resigned, he went to a public reception at the British Museum, just carrying on normal, doing his public things. And Ian Hislop, the editor of Private Eye, you might have seen in the papers, met him at this reception. What are you doing here the day after you resigned? and you still hear it at public function, and it was sort of all over the newspapers, the hypocrisy of it, the double standards of it. And Jesus says, well, that goes to the heart of it. There's one persona on the outside, and there's something else going on the inside. And your obsession with religious washing, it only touches the outside. And I've got nothing against you washing your hands, but what about the inside? Shouldn't you be concerned about that as well? Now, even as I say this, now Jesus is talking to people who basically hate him, think he's from demon-possessed, in the end want to kill him. So, these aren't friends of Jesus. But even as I say this, I think we also feel a bit uncomfortable, as I do. Just everything on the outside looks great, but what about the... And you're thinking, what about the inside of me? I hope you are, anyway. If you are, that's really good news, actually. Because one of the problems with these Pharisees is Jesus' comments just bounce off them. And they won't hear them. So if you're like me, feeling a bit convicted, sometimes I do put on a nicer Christian external face and hide some of the mess that's inside me. Even admitting that is a step in the right direction more than these guys. Jesus urges us, 41, give as alms those things that are within, which is quite a strange phrase. Alms, it just means giving to the poor, giving money to help those who are in need. And the Pharisees do it outside, so they wash on the outside, they give alms on the outside, ostentatiously, here's a big charity donation in the name of the Andrew Sachs Foundation, please will you put that on the engraving outside your building, that sort of public display of generosity. And Jesus says, do generosity inside you. Have a heart that's generous, not just the outside persona. So it's actually an invitation here. He's saying there's something wrong on the inside, but I'm inviting you to sort out the inside with my help. And if you hear it and you think, yeah, there is something wrong on the inside, I want to sort out the inside, that's a good start. But they don't want to do that. Six woes. I've highlighted them all in the text, and I've tried to give a little slogan to sort of capture what they're about on the outline, on the order of service. So woe, firstly, woe, you pick and choose when it comes to God's law. Woe to you Pharisees, you tithe mint and rue in every herb and neglect justice and the love of God. You should have done these without neglecting the others. I don't know whether they actually did this, whether Jesus just doing one of his illustrations that just, goes to absurdity to show it. But tithing, it's the idea in the Old Testament, in the Bible, that you give away a tenth of what you have to those in need. And so you're generous with your income. And it's a good rule of thumb for the Christian as well. Maybe you get a certain amount to live on as your student loan, or you get a certain amount on your salary or whatever it is. And then all through history, Christians have said, well, 10% of that I won't keep for myself, I'll give away to others. But they do this, they do it to the nth degree. So they tithe 10% of their herb. I should have brought in one of my little, I was actually thinking of it, one of my little Schwartz, the Schwartz spice jars, about so big. And you can imagine them pouring it out and very carefully taking one-tenth of this oregano I'm going to give away to poor people who can't afford oregano. And then I do the same with my sumac, and then the same with my mint. And it's like, really? They're like scrupulously meticulous about following God's regulation to the letter. In fact, the Old Testament doesn't say anything about tithing mint, just tithing your wages generally. But they go to the nth degree, and you think, oh, they're very serious about religion. But actually, they're not. Because Jesus says, you do this, you neglect justice and the love of God. Like the inside you things that really matter, you don't do. But the external, super religious, meticulous things, you do. Listen to John Calvin on this. I think it's a really helpful comment. This is his writing in the 16th century about this passage. But it's just contemporary for today. Christ charges the scribes with a fault, which is found in all hypocrites, that they are exceedingly diligent and careful in small matters, but disregard the principal points of the law. This disease has prevailed in almost all ages and among all nations, so that people have in most cases endeavoured to please God by observing with exactness some trivial matters. Finding they cannot entirely release themselves from all obedience to God, they have recourse to this remedy of expiating any heinous offences by satisfactions which are of no value. To expose more fully, to ridicule their offensive ostentation. He doesn't say generally that they paid tithes, but they paid tithes of mint and aniseed and every kind of herb, so as to make a display of extraordinary zeal for piety at the least possible expense. Isn't that interesting? What do you give 10% of? The thing that cost, what's a packet of mint, or, you know, four quid? Watch me scrupulously give a tenth of my 4 quid mint. Meanwhile, I keep everything else to myself. It's an exactness in the small things. Now, I remember this when I grew up, actually. I was in a church where I didn't really hear the gospel about Jesus. There wasn't much Bible. There wasn't much love. But there was exactness in religious performance. You know, we had to bow at exactly the right point. We had to wear exactly the right colours. And if a bit of communion wine got spilt, you know, that was absolutely crisis. And it had to be cleaned away in exactly the right way, and with holy water and so on. But meanwhile, no actual love of God. Jesus says, woe to that. And maybe we feel that. You know, there's some Christian things that are easy to do. They don't cost us very much. We do those, make sure we do those very publicly. But then the things that get to the heart of it, as Jesus says here, justice, what is right, and the love of God, well, we can forsake those. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others. Then the next one, verse 43, woe to you Pharisees, you love the best seats in the synagogues and the greetings in the marketplace. You ask yourself, why bother to tithe the mint? Why bother to do all the washing on the outside? And the answer is, well, it gets you kudos. Oh, he's so religious. He's so pious. And he's such a spiritual man, our pastor, Andrew Satch. Oh, I quite like that reputation. Oh, maybe I'll get a special invitation to the civic function for the Reverend Dr. Satch from Greenwich. And I don't, by the way, because we're not a church that's sort of highly esteemed by the civic authorities. But you can imagine, you know, it's quite nice to have a seat in the House of Lords. It's quite nice to be welcomed deferentially by the local officials. And they love the reputation of religion, but without the heart of it. And then this is the, I think, the most chilling thing of all, verse 44. Woe to you, you're like unmarked graves, and people walk over them without knowing it. Now, I was puzzling about this. What is Jesus getting at with this image? You're an unmarked grave. People walk over them without knowing it. I think it's this. You put other people at spiritual risk. Unmarked graves, I mean, it's dangerous for a couple of reasons. I mean, one, you might fall in. It's like saying it's like a manhole without the cover on, you know, without a sign saying, watch out, manhole. And people are walking over, and then suddenly they disappear. I can't do that very dramatically, but if I was a better actor, you can imagine. And suddenly, doom! It could mean that in that sense, or it could just mean in the sense that a grave made you unclean in the old, according to the law of God. So, if you were to touch a dead body, you become ritually unclean. Well, you're unclean, but you're not even warning people that you are. So people go to you thinking that they're going to get close to God. Oh, I'll go to the scribe, I'll go to the vicar, I'll go to church. That'll be my access spiritually to get nearer to Jesus. But actually, you're a danger to them spiritually. You're making them contaminated ritually. And there's no warning, is there? That's the frightening thing about the fake church. It looks like a church on the outside. We're in the case in England now, you probably realise this, where a great many churches aren't faithful to the teaching of Jesus. And I don't want to say this in a sort of self-congratulatory way, like, oh, well done, Grace Church Greenwich, we're the only faithful ones. There are many faithful ones, and we've got to make sure that we're a faithful one. So I don't mean like, hooray for us and boo to everyone else. That's not the point of this. But it is the case that there are many fake churches in this country. And it's always been like that, actually. Jesus warned of it. He called them wolves in sheep's clothing. People who look like sheep, but actually are trying to devour you. And it is the case around the country. But that's scary, isn't it? Because if you've got a friend who's interested in knowing about Jesus, where are they going to go? Well, just to a church. They'll think, oh, you know, I'm quite interested in taking this Jesus thing a bit further. I'll just get along to my local church. And that always scares me, because I think, I don't know whether that church is going to be faithful to Jesus or not. It'd be much easier, wouldn't it, if there's a sign outside saying, warning, death here. You're like a marked grave. And Jesus says, you're like unmarked graves. People don't even realise the danger that they're in. Well, maybe, as I say, there's people here today who've had that kind of experience of religion in the past. The fake kind, where you've been exploited or abused. And you went there because you wanted to get Jesus. But instead you got something that was deathly. Jesus hates that. And he says to these hypocrites, woe to you. Well, we're sort of halfway through the passage. And then the lawyers over here, the scribes. By the way, by lawyers, I kept it as lawyers. I could have put it as something like scribes or something. It doesn't mean people who work for the respectful legal profession. It means people who consider themselves experts in God's law. So they're like another group like the Pharisees. But I kind of kept it in because it was fun, because I'm sure there are some actual lawyers here. I was actually, years ago, I've got one of my best friends is a lawyer, and obviously I'm a vicar, and we were just talking about this passage. And I was like, she said, well, that bit's about you, and this bit's about me, so that's going to come as papers. It's not actually about the lawyers in the church, but these people who consider themselves experts in God's law. Now, this is a real turning point, because they overhear the conversation, and they've got a choice now, right? And I suppose it's the same choice as we've got. Overhearing Jesus roasting these Pharisees, what's your response going to be? Because you could go, Jesus, there but for the grace of God go I. Please don't let me be like that. Or you could go, Jesus, I am a bit like that. I'll be honest with you. Like, sometimes I prioritize the external thing that everyone sees instead of the heart thing. Or Jesus, sometimes I pick and choose, and I don't mind obeying you if something doesn't cost me, like tithing mint. But I'm reluctant to follow you in things that are more sort of fundamental. That's me. Please have mercy on me, Jesus. That would be a good response. A worse response would be the one that I guess is quite contemporary, isn't it, in our society? I'm offended by that. He's caused me offence. He shouldn't be allowed to say that because I'm offended. It sounds very 21st century. That's what they do. Teacher, in saying these things, you insult us also. And you expect yourself, sorry, lawyers, I didn't mean that. Obviously not you, because you're great. But, I mean, just this is those Pharisees, you see. He doubles down. Well, since you're feeling offended, verse 46, woe to you, lawyers, also. For you load people with burdens hard to bear. And you yourself do not touch the burdens with one of your fingers. I love them. Jesus is so, his images are so dramatic, aren't they? So here am I heaping upon people extra burdens. You can imagine, again, I hear this to myself, you can imagine a minister of a church doing this. You know, all the people in the church are running around all the time, and I'm giving them more and more to do. And it's not just saying, you know, serve your church faithfully, it's saying run in circles around these ridiculous rules that we've made. So you see a little bit of them, for example, on the Sabbath, when they've decided that any kind of activity that blesses you is actually counts as work and you shouldn't be allowed to do it. So people are going through the cornfields, snacking on bits of corn, breaking the Sabbath, not allowed. I think today, actually, some brands of Orthodox Judaism aren't allowed to turn on light switches on a Saturday because that counts as work because you've got to touch it. I don't know whether the automatic scanning, you know, I don't know if that's allowed, but it's an attempt to be very precise about all these things. And you make life almost unlivable. But it's one thing if that was out of a sincere desire to honour God, but the irony is that you make everyone else do this, load them with heavy burdens, and you yourselves do not touch the burdens with one of your fingers. I love that. Here's someone staggering along, and it's not, oh, let me give you a bit of a hand. They won't even touch it with one of their fingers. It's kind of abusive, isn't it? The hypocrisy. Verse 47. Woe to you. This is the most complicated one to understand, but we're almost there. Woe to you. You build the tombs of the prophets whom your fathers killed. So you're witnesses, and you consent to the deeds of your fathers. For they killed them, and you build their tombs. Therefore also the wisdom of God said, I'll send them prophets and apostles, some of whom they'll kill and persecute, so that the blood of all the prophets shed from the foundation of the world may be charged against this generation, from the blood of Abel to the blood of Zechariah, who perished between the altar and the sanctuary. Yes, I tell you, it will be required of this generation. It's a bit weird here, but I think what's going on is they are commemorating the tombs of ancient prophets of God who've been killed. So it's part of their religion. They celebrate, they venerate these past saints. But Jesus says, as you venerate them, you're kind of making yourself guilty because you are complicit in their death. Like, you know, you build the tomb of Zechariah, or you decorate the tomb of Zechariah. But people like you hated Zechariah. You know, why are you now jumping to Zechariah's commemoration to sort of side with him, when actually you're exactly the kind of people that he opposed? I find it hard to get my head around this, but a friend of mine shared this brilliant illustration, which I think helps. It's a guy called Robert George, Professor Robert George, who you may have come across. He's a professor of jurisprudence at Princeton and quite an outspoken political thinker and a Christian thinker in America. And apparently he does a class which he teaches to all the first years at Princeton University. He comes to his class. And he basically asked them, put your hand up if you think you would have opposed the slave trade if you'd been around 150 years ago. If you think you would have stood up against everybody, put your hand up. And they, of course, everyone does. They all, I would do it on you, but it's a bit mean. They all put their hand up. And then he says, okay, now write down on a piece of paper the thing that you believe in that is unpopular with everybody else. And if people knew that you stood for it, they'd ostracize you and marginalize you. But nonetheless, you're going to stand up for it. Write that down. And, you know, not many of them could. A couple of them could. Like, well, you know, some person says, oh, I'm pro-life, you know, put that down. But most people, because they couldn't think of anything. And he said, I don't believe you, then, about the first question. I assure you, all of you would have gone along with the slave trade. It's hypocrisy. You know, like, unless you're actually willing to suffer for your unpopular beliefs, you would not have stood against it. And, you know, the couple of people who were unpopular, like, here's a Christian who's pro-life. Yeah, okay, I believe you, yeah. You're willing to be hated now. You would have been willing to be hated 150 years ago. The rest of you, no. And yet, everyone wants to claim William Wilberforce as their hero, don't they? People are falling over themselves and say, oh, he's my hero. You know, ended slavery. I'm with him. Yeah, you weren't with him. You wouldn't have been with him. You'd have hated him. It's the same irony as some people in the church today who, well, they'll celebrate the feast days of various sort of biblical characters. He's teaching they hate. It's a sort of irony a bit. They'll champion some of the heroes of church history, like Augustine, Athanasius, who they would have opposed. That's what Jesus is getting at, I think. You build the tombs of the prophets, and they're the ones that your fathers killed. And so you kind of condemn yourself by this hypocrisy. Like, from the blood of Abel to the blood of Zechariah. This works even better in English than it does in the original language, because it looks like A to Z, the A to Z of your crimes. It's not, unfortunately, in Greek, Z is the fifth letter of the alphabet, so it doesn't work quite as well. But in English it works well, because it's the last letter of the alphabet. But it's actually probably the first and the last person that they killed in the Old Testament. Abel is the first victim of murder. Zechariah is the last. It's the end of the book of 2 Chronicles. But it's just a category. You always oppose God's people. It's quite a thing to say to Jewish religious leaders, isn't it? Now, this isn't anti-Semitic, by the way, because, I mean, Jesus is Jewish. All of his followers are Jewish. All of the early church are Jewish. We're not being anti-Jewish here. That's just anti-Semitism is ridiculous for Christians. Because, you know, look up the ethnicity of your saviour. Well, he's a Jew, right? It's not anti-Semitism. But nonetheless, it is a punch right into the heart of the religious establishment. You who consider yourselves the descendants of Abel and Zechariah, you'd have killed them if you had the chance. And of course, well, it's the last prophet he's been killed here until one more is killed at the end of Luke's Gospel, which is himself. You're going to kill me, give him the chance. And I think the same is true even today, that there are religious leaders who misrepresent Jesus, who twist his teaching, and have the audacity to claim Jesus on their side. No, he says, Jesus, you're the ones who would have killed me. Well, I suppose here's the test of it. When Jesus roasts you, what's your response? Do you go, oh, sorry, Jesus. You know, that is uncomfortably true about me on the inside sometimes. Please have mercy on me. You do that, that's a really good sign. I mean, that's why in Luke's Gospel, generally, the people who love Jesus the most are the people who are willing to admit that. So tax collectors, who were sort of despised traitors, they loved him. Prostitutes loved him. People in the act, because they were willing to admit, yes, I'm a mess and I need help. And they were very popular with Jesus. But the religious people, what are they going to do when Jesus points the finger at them? Well, you can see verse 53. It's actually the worst verse of the whole chapter. Verse 53, as he went away from there, the scribes and the Pharisees began to press him hard and provoke him to speak about many things, lying in wait for him to catch him in something he might say. Such a sinister end, isn't it? I suppose it's like normal. I mean, you hear these videos on the internet, so-and-so raised so-and-so. The other person never says, oh, yeah, fair point. Yeah, I'm really sorry. I was wrong. They never say that, did they? They always fight back. I suppose it's human nature. But it's pretty discouraging when the person who's exposing you is God, when he's lovingly put his finger on something wrong inside, and your response, instead of humbling yourself, your response is to look for ways of killing him, arresting him. Let's see if we can catch him in something he could say so that we can get him. And from now on, really, they're on the lookout for what could be his end. Pretty worrying response. There's an irony, I think, in verse 54 as well. They lie in wait for him to catch him in something he might say. He's already said six things. Somehow none of those count. So you see that they're looking for material for a court case against Jesus, something that a soundbite that they can use against him. But they can't use any of these things. Why? I think because they're all true, aren't they? You can't win a libel case against somebody for things they printed that are true. So they'll look up something else. Well, some responses. How will they respond? Terribly, really terribly. This is the worst response of all. To hear the warning and then to just, well, not only shove it back in Jesus' face, but then to look for ways to oppose him even more. And I suppose the question then is, how do we respond? Now, Jesus isn't talking to us, really. Like I said, he's talking to his enemies who think he's demon-possessed, who want to kill him. Hopefully that isn't most of us. Nonetheless, though, you hear a passage like this, you can't help but examine your own heart, which is a really, really healthy thing to do. There's an invitation there, isn't it? Do something about it. I'm telling you this so that you can do something about it. It's not the healthy who need a doctor, said Jesus, but the sick. Well, I've told you you're sick. Are you going to come to the doctor? I hope that we will respond like that. And in a minute, in fact, we're going to say together some words that will enable us to respond like that. Jesus, that's a bit true of me on the inside. Sort me out, please. But also, I hope you're a bit encouraged that the people who rejected Jesus, well, they did so for terrible reasons, and they were fakes. And I hope you're encouraged if you've had a bad experience of religion in the past, and some of you will have done. The people who treated you like that, they were fakes. Jesus hates it. That's not the real thing. He's against them. So even though learning to type the wrong way is a hindrance, and you know, the violin the wrong way, or golf the wrong way, or religion the wrong way is a hindrance, it's not too late to reset. So Jesus, I want your kind of religion. The painful, exposing, looking inside me, telling me some difficult kind of home truths kind. I want that kind, please. And I'm going to walk away from the scribes and the Pharisees who taught me previously, because it's fake. Well, it's a hard sermon to give, I tell you, because as a teacher in a church, I've got to examine myself. We've all got to examine ourselves. And we're going to say together some words from... We normally do our congregational...